Unit 2, like I think all the rest of the units, will be three chapters. That first unit was four, I believe. Anyway, the first of the chapters in this new unit is all about the structure and function of large biological molecules, which is actually the title, very descriptive. We've already talked about large biological molecules a little bit, which are called macromolecules, right? Biological macromolecules. And how many categories are there?
Four.
All right. Who wants to show off and say all of them? Go ahead.
Lipids.
Lipids is one.
Proteins.
Polysaccharides. Right? And nucleic acids. Exactly. So those are the big ones. All of them are absolutely indispensable to life. You need them for several reasons. Of course, they're not the only molecules. There's plenty of run-of-the-mill small molecules in cells as well. But this chapter is about the big molecules. And we'll survey them one at a time eventually, but this is a kind of a general slide to open things up. Now, of those four categories, they're all macromolecules, so they're all relatively big molecules compared to most molecules. But only three of those four actually officially qualify as polymers. A polymer is so named because it is many parts. Poly means many, mer means part. A polymer is constructed by hooking together a bunch of monomers, or one-parters. Monomers are not macromolecules, but when you hook enough monomers together, you make a big molecule called a polymer. Well, not all four of the macromolecules classes are actually polymers. One of them is not. It's constructed a little bit differently. Which one do you think that is of the four that you just mentioned? Anyone know, or do you want to guess?
Proteins.
No, proteins are polymers.
Nucleic acids.
Nucleic acids are polymers. Lipids are not polymers. So they're also not as big as the other three, but they are, I consider them macromolecules. They're just not built like polymers. All right, and I'll talk more about that, polymers in general, as we go. But the reason I'm mentioning that right now is that this slide uses the word polymer and monomer here, so it's building a polymer. And I don't want you to be confused by that, because the important point of this slide is true of all four categories, including lipids. All right, so it's using an example of a polymer, but it's true even of lipids. And the main point here is that cells need to build big molecules out of smaller molecules, because the macromolecules that all cells need, we don't take those into our cells. They're too big for that. Where do we get the stuff that we build our molecules out of? We, as examples, from the food we eat, right? But we don't put food into our body. We say that we do all the time, but we don't. We put food into a tube called the alimentary canal, which is a continuous tunnel from mouth to anus, which is continuous with the air around us at both ends, right? Our body is made of the cells, and those cells form a mass that surrounds that tunnel. So our body is kind of like the stuff of a bagel. The hole in the middle of the bagel is like the alimentary canal, right? If you stick your finger through the hole of the bagel, it's not in the bagel. And similarly, the stuff we put into our throat is not in our body. And it's too big to put into the cells. That's why we have to first digest it while it's still outside of our body in that canal. We break the big molecules, the macromolecules that the cells of whatever organisms we ate were made of. into small chunks, small molecules that are then small enough to absorb into the cells of our body. That's when it finally is in your body, but by then it's no longer food. And then we use those small pieces to build our own versions of macromolecules. All right? And so cells all the time have to build bigger things out of smaller things, and they also need to do the reverse, break bigger things into smaller things. That's what this slide is all about. And for all four of the macromolecules, this involves two pieces. Well, at the top, we're talking about building big from small. And this involves having two pieces that are joined together. And in all cases, one of those pieces is going to have an H somewhere, a hydrogen somewhere, and the other one's going to have an OH somewhere. And those get removed. The OH gets removed from one chunk, the H gets removed from another chunk. And when those are combined, an OH and an H, that makes water, H2O. And so water is removed in this process of linking together two pieces to make a bigger piece. And that is why that kind of reaction, which joins two things together, is called a dehydration reaction. Because water comes out, which is what dehydration means, right? But think about this in terms of the molecular models you used. If you take an H off of one piece and an OH off another piece, you're leaving a hole in each piece, right? Which is required for you to be able to then bond those two pieces together. Each of them has to have a hole available. So that's what this little line between 3 and 4 represents, filling the holes that you left when you take out the OH and the H to make water. Yeah?
What is a monomer? Is H2O a monomer?
Well, a monomer isn't a specific thing. It is simply any single piece that is used to construct a polymer. So for the three polymer classes that we named, there are specific kinds of monomers that we're going to talk about for each one. But water is not really a monomer. It's not used to build big pieces. It's just a small molecule, an important one, but a small molecule.
So like for proteins, would amino acids be some monomers?
Yes. Any polymer is made out of some specific monomers, but what those monomers are depend on what kind of polymer it is. But that's exactly right. For any polypeptide, which is a protein, the individual monomers are amino acids, as we'll get to. Okay, now the bottom is exactly the reverse. So it's not possible, it's not just possible to build things out of small. The cells have to be able to deconstruct the big ones, which is how we get energy out of our food, for instance. That reverse process, exactly the opposite of dehydration, is called hydrolysis. Notice that hydro is in there again, because being the reverse, it involves water again, but in the reverse direction. Instead of water coming out to join two things, you have to put water in to split two things. And that's exactly what the word lysis, if it's by itself, lysis is a word unto itself, means. It means splitting. So hydrolysis means water splitting, literally, but it's using water to split a big chunk into smaller chunks. And the reason water is necessary is that water itself gets split to supply an H for one of the chunks to fill its hole and an OH for the other chunk, exactly the reverse of dehydration. Sometimes dehydration reactions are called, by some books, condensation reactions. That's a totally interchangeable name. It's exactly the same thing. But the word dehydration really tells you what's going on more than condensation does. All right. Now we can go into the survey of the four categories one at a time. Starting with polysaccharides, even though slide 2 doesn't feature any polysaccharides. Polysaccharides are polymers. Polymers are built by hooking monomers together. So what we're looking at here are carbohydrates. Remember what I said about carbohydrate not being the appropriate term for one of the four categories of macromolecules, because carbohydrates don't have to be big, right? Well, here, these are all carbohydrates, but none of them is big. These are all monosaccharides, which are small carbohydrates. But monosaccharides are the monomers that, when hooked together, form the polymers called polysaccharides. The saccharide part of it means sugar. Specifically, the saccharide part of that word means sugar. And mono means one, right? So it's a simple one-piece sugar. That's what the word monosaccharide tells you. And monosaccharides are carbohydrates, as I've just said, but I want to remind you not to confuse carbohydrate with the similar word hydrocarbon. Right? A hydrocarbon contains only carbon and hydrogen. A carbohydrate contains carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, as you can see in all these examples. Now, the reason that carbohydrates were named what they are is that a monosaccharide, which is a simple carbohydrate, has a general formula that is CnH2nOn. N can be any integer. What it means here is that however many carbons there are, which is the N value, there's twice that many hydrogens, and there's the same number, N again, of oxygens. Well, that's true for any given monosaccharide, but notice that you could use kind of the distributive property in math to rewrite this as CN, and then in parentheses, H2O N. H2NON, see that? But when you write it this way, it looks like a monosaccharide is part carbon and part water, because H2O is water. Even though that technically that's not really what it is, that's what it looks like by the formula, and that's why it's called a carbohydrate, carbon and water. All right? So, as far as monosaccharides are concerned, what can you say? Well, let me just say that this table illustrates two completely different ways of categorizing monosaccharides. There's all kinds of monosaccharides, way more than we ever encounter in our food. If you just think of them as chemicals, there's really no limit to the number of carbohydrates that you could produce. But, I mean, the number of monosaccharides, sorry. But anyway, these two ways of classifying them have nothing to do with each other. They're fundamentally separate. One of them, though, is really illustrated by the columns, the other one by the rows. Let's look at the columns. And what you see is that in this first column, these two examples, which are not the only examples, glyceraldehyde and dihydroxyacetone, have exactly the same chemical formula as each other. They're both C3H6O3. What does that qualify them as being, by the way? Just that fact.
Is that an isomer?
Yes, they are isomers of each other. Now, monosaccharides, or sugars in general, and by the way, some books don't use the word sugar unless they're specifically talking about a monosaccharide. Other books use sugars to mean any carbohydrate, so it's kind of confusing. But anyway, the suffix meaning sugar is OSE. So carbohydrate names typically end in OSE, including monosaccharide names. Well, in this case, these two monosaccharides are classified as trioses because they are three carbon sugars. The tri tells you that there's three carbons in the skeleton, and the os tells you that it's a sugar. And similarly, the pentoses have five carbons, not just these two. Any five-carbon monosaccharide is a pentose, and there are many hexoses, and so on. So one way of classifying monosaccharides is based on the number of carbons in the skeleton. All right, triose is not a substance. It's a category, right? There are so many trioses. There are so many pentoses. Each one has a specific name, though. All right, now, if you look at these structural formulae, What do you notice is true of all of them other than they have carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen? Were you asking a question? Okay. And how is it connected to the oxygen? Yes, eat every monosaccharide in this form. I'm going to tell you about different forms in a minute. Contain a carbonyl group. That's the C double bond O. Remember your functional groups? So that's true for all of these and for monosaccharides in general. But remember back to when we learned functional groups, I said that a carbonyl group, there are two different kinds of substances that contain carbonyl group, two categories, right? Because a carbonyl group, which has a carbon, can be either at the tip of a skeleton somewhere or not. That's when I told you the alphabetic trick, right? A, as in aldehyde, is at the tip of the alphabet. K, as in ketone, is not at the tip of the alphabet. Well, notice the difference between the rows here. Glyceraldehyde has a carbonyl at the tip. So does ribose, glucose, galactose. So those all qualify as aldehydes, right? Aldehydes have carbonyls at a tip. And so they are aldehyde sugars. And that category is therefore named aldoses, which means aldehyde sugars. These, on the other hand, are not at a tip. The carbonyls are not at a tip on the bottom row. So they're all ketones or ketoses, ketone sugars. All right, those are monosaccharides. So is the one we're looking at in slide 3. But in slide 2, all of those examples were in linear form. You built glucose with the model, right? But you built the linear form, meaning that the skeleton had two ends. It didn't wrap around and form a ring. But importantly, any given monosaccharide can be in either linear form or ringed form. It's the same named substance, like glucose, for instance, but there are two different versions as far as structure is concerned. And you can see a linear form right here. Is this an aldehyde or a ketone? Right, it's at the tip. And right here it's kind of folding. It's on its way to making a ring. And then finally it is a ring. But think about this in terms of molecular modeling again. If you're going to complete a ring, you can't do that, which requires making a bond, right? Unless you remove some atoms to make holes so that you can make that complete ring. Does that make sense? And this is why the carbonyl group, which is taking up two holes in carbon, loses that double bond. It just becomes a single bond, and the oxygen loses a hydrogen to make a hole in the oxygen here so that the two can be sewn together to make the ring. What this means is that linear and ringed forms of the same monosaccharide are different in that the ringed form of the monosaccharide does not have a carbonyl group, whereas the linear form does. And we'll say something about that more in lab once we get there.
Do specific ones just automatically turn into rings, or do something have to happen to them to go from linear form?
Oh, that's a good question, because it reminds me of something else too. No, they all are doing this, and notice the double arrows here. This is a reversible reaction, and it happens many, many times per second. So if a monosaccharide is an individual monosaccharide, in other words, it's not hooked to something bigger, then it's flipping back and forth between ringed and linear form all the time. So I'm glad you asked that. But here in 4, we can see that monosaccharides don't have to exist by themselves. Right? As I've already told you, They are building blocks for building larger molecules, bigger carbohydrates in this case. And here we can see that happening using two glucoses at the top left. These are identical glucose molecules, but they're being hooked together to form one bigger maltose molecule. Notice it ends in OSE also, but maltose is not a monosaccharide. It's two monosaccharides hooked together, so it therefore is a disaccharide. It's not yet big enough to be a polysaccharide, and I shouldn't say yet because there's nothing saying you have to keep going. You could just make a maltose and stop there. But what I'm saying is that it's kind of a word game when it's finally big enough to qualify as polysaccharides. We can talk about trisaccharides and, you know, use a lot of different words. Eventually it becomes poly. But maltose is a disaccharide. Now the important thing here, or one important thing, is that to make a disaccharide, or to hook together any two monosaccharides, not just for maltose, and this is true whether you're making a disaccharide or anything bigger, you can't use the linear versions of the monosaccharides. The monosaccharides, if they're going to be linked, have to be in ringed form, which is why you see glucose in the ringed form here being linked. All right, now, notice the pattern that we just talked about in the first slide. One of the chunks has an OH somewhere, another chunk has an H somewhere. That gets removed as water. This is a dehydration reaction, which always builds bigger things out of smaller. Now, in the specific case of using a dehydration reaction to link specifically two monosaccharides together, then the bond that gets formed in that process has a special name called glycosidic linkage. Glyco means sugar. All right, so we'll talk about different names for bonds made in the other categories of big molecules that get formed similarly. It's going to be a dehydration reaction in all those cases, but the bond gets named differently depending on what you're building. You build up larger carbohydrates by linking them together with glycosidic linkages. On the bottom, we can see that it doesn't have to be two identical monosaccharides. It can be, but it doesn't have to be that you link together. Here we're making table sugar, which is sucrose, out of glucose and fructose, two monosaccharides, to form sucrose, a disaccharide. So just like when we say just salt, which is one of many salts, we're usually referring to table salt, sodium chloride. When we say just sugar, usually outside of science, that means specifically a disaccharide, sucrose. Now, while we're still on this slide, notice that the OH and the H used in the dehydration reaction are not the only OH and H available to these chunks, on these chunks, right? There's also other places where you have H's and OH's. That's important because that means a single monosaccharide can form multiple glycosidic linkages, meaning be connected to more than just one other monosaccharide. And what that means is that there can be branching. Since there's multiple places where the next one can be hooked, there can be branching in the bigger molecule. As we'll see later, that's not true for the other two kinds of polymers. Proteins don't branch, and neither do nucleic acids. Polysaccharides don't have to branch, but they can. Well, now in 5, we finally get a view of a full-blown polysaccharide. Two of them, actually. Starch on the left, glycogen on the right. Now, these both are examples of one of two categories of polysaccharides. Polysaccharides can be lumped into either of two categories based on the function of the molecule. So there's functional classifications. The two categories are storage polysaccharides and structural polysaccharides. Does anyone know which of those two categories both of these belongs to? These are storage polysaccharides. I like the confidence. Was that a guess?
Yes.
Okay. What qualifies a polysaccharide as storage polysaccharide is that the reason it was built by the cell is for the purpose of storing energy for later. As we'll talk much more about in Unit 3, monosaccharides are excellent fuels. They are the main fuels in all cells. And your brain, which really defines you, uses glucose almost exclusively. But I'm not talking about just your own cells. All cells in biology, all living cells, have glucose as the master fuel. It's used more often than any other fuel. So there's a lot of available energy in glucose, is what I'm saying. Well, when an organism has extra glucose, meaning more energy than is needed at the moment, then the extra can be stored for later. You know, for us animals, for instance, we don't take in food continuously at tiny, tiny amounts, right? As animals, we eat a meal, which we carry around with us still outside of our body, as I said, but we then digest it and absorb it. So sometime after a meal, there is a hell of a lot of glucose coming into the bloodstream once it finally gets digested and absorbed. Way more than the body needs at the moment. And that rise in blood glucose level can be harmful, right? It would be an error. So a major function of your liver, for instance, is to take that extra glucose out of the blood when it's in extra supply and hook them together into a more compact version for later use. And we call that glycogen. That's the animal version of storage polysaccharide. The thing about glycogen, though, or starch for that matter, which is the plant's version, they do the same thing to make starch. It's made of nothing but glucose is hooked together, and glucose is the main fuel, but neither of these is a fuel by itself. In other words, we can't use glycogen as fuel, we can't use starch as fuel. We have to break it down into glucose and use the individual glucose molecules as fuel. But it's worth going through this hooking them together process because it stores them much more efficiently without all those waters that come out in the dehydration reactions to link them together. It's a compact form of storing the glucoses. The intent, though, and this is why they're called storage polysaccharides, is to break that thing down again, which your liver will do hours later when it's been a long time since you've eaten and your blood glucose level goes down below normal. Then it will reverse the process, break the glycogen into individual glucoses, put the glucoses into the blood, and allow you to remain alive because the brain needs a continuous stream of glucose. Similarly in a plant, but they make starch, which notice can either be totally unbranching or have just not many branches. It's all glucose, just like glycogen is, but we animals make a lot of branches. And this is what I was talking about before. You can't have branching unless there are multiple places where you can have dehydration reactions linked together monomers. The reason that animals make a bunch of branches is because the more tips you have, the quicker it is to break it down, which is important for an animal because we can't survive nearly as long as a plant can. You know, things happen more slowly in plants. All right, so those are storage polysaccharides. Now, 6 shows you one of each category. This is starch, which we just looked at, pure glucose. Cellulose is on the right, and that's an example of a structural polysaccharide, which get their name because the purpose for building them is not to store energy for later use, Instead, they're more or less permanent structures built for the purpose of being structural components. They act like little ropes. Cellulose fibers, which is what you produce when you have enough glucose strung together, act like little ropes. They're able to withstand tensile forces or stretching forces, just like ropes do. And so, yes, they are full of glucose, which could be used as energy, but in this case, the glucoses are not going to be used for energy because they're going to stay in the cellulose as a structure. Now, we already talked about the fact that there's two different versions of glucose because it's a monosaccharide. So there's a linear form and a ringed form, right? But there's even multiple ringed forms. Alpha glucose here, beta glucose here. And if you look at the structural formula, you can see that they're almost identical, but not quite. Remember when I talked about enantiomers? In what situation do you have enantiomers? What has to be true of the carbon involved in an enantiomer? You remember what enantiomers are? They're one of the three categories of isomers we studied. There's the ones that have chirality, handedness. And remember the picture at the bottom with the right and left hands? And you also had two tetrahedrons, right? That happens, you have a right and a left hand version whenever you have a central carbon connected to four different things. Just like this carbon here. Every corner of these figures, unless there's some other symbol there, like O, an unlabeled corner is a carbon. So this is a carbon, and it's connected to four different things. And when that happens, remember that there's mirror images of each other. The only difference between alpha and beta glucose is that these two are switched in this position. And if you use alpha glucoses and hook them together, you make starch. If you hook beta glucoses together, you make cellulose, a structural polysaccharide. Slide 7 shows you a few in detail a few cellulose fibers. Each of these strings is one cellulose fiber. So it's one enormous molecule made out of many, many glucoses hooked together. But notice that they're arranged, many of them, many individual celluloses are side by side or wrapped in parallel, just like the strands of a rope, which makes it very strong stuff. And that's why they're called structural polysaccharides. It's all about being a structure. Cell walls, which plants have, are made of mostly cellulose. And speaking of that, slide 8, picture of a cow eating grass. Grass has a lot of cellulose in it, just like any plant does, because every cell of a plant has that cellulose in the cell wall. And like I've said, every cellulose molecule is really nothing but glucoses. So there's the potential of a lot of energy to be used if you eat cellulose, because it's chock full of glucose, right? Well, we eat cellulose all the time. Any plant that you eat has a lot of cellulose coming in. There's other sources as well. But when we take in cellulose as food, we can't get any energy out of it. We don't absorb it into our body because we can't break it down into small enough chunks to absorb it. So it stays outside of our body in the alimentary canal and passes through as roughage, which is important for its own reasons, but it doesn't give us any nutrition, even though it's the most important source of energy when you get to the monomers. We just can't break them apart. The reason we can't break them apart is because doing that requires an enzyme to break that linkage. Enzymes are proteins. And remember that you're stuck with the kinds of proteins you're able to build, because no cell knows how to build a protein unless it has instructions for how to do that, and that's what your genes are. Well, we animals don't have the gene that codes for how to build the protein required to act as the enzyme that breaks these glycosidic linkages to digest cellulose into glucose. Neither does this cow, by the way, which is a fellow mammal, but it still gets nutrition from the grass it eats, from the cellulose that's in the grass, unlike us, because in one of its stomachs, it has trillions of bacteria living in there, and those bacteria do have the correct gene to break those bonds. So this is, it's not the cow's proteins that are breaking the links, it's the bacteria, their proteins breaking the links. And this is an example, by the way, of a symbiosis. A word from ecology, sim means together, bi as in biology means live, and osis means condition. So symbiosis is a condition of living together. Two different species having a pretty close relationship somehow is a symbiosis. And this is more specifically an example of endosymbiosis, endo meaning within, situation of one species living inside the other species. Now, that does not have to be good for both involved. For instance, a parasite is another endosymbiosis. But in some cases, it does benefit both of the species involved, in which case we call it mutualism. This is an example of mutualism because it's good for the bacteria. They have a nice, safe place to live with continuous temperature, continuous moisture, continuous supply of food, as long as the cow is alive and eating. And so they're happy. But it also benefits the cow, of course, because even though the bacteria are not trying to help the cow, they're simply eating their food, and they're breaking those linkages so that they can get the glucose, it still leaves plenty of glucose for the cow itself. Early on, yes. Just like exposure to certain things in the environment for an infant is important for development of immunity, for instance. You know, breastfeeding gives things to the infant that are required for that as well, yeah.
What did he say symbiosis was then?
The condition of two species living together closely for some reason. So if we underwent genetic engineering and inserted the gene for the enzyme that breaks glycosidic linkages in cellulose, we could eat paper or whatever and get nutrition from it. Well, I don't want you to have the idea that only plants make structural polysaccharides. They make most of them because cellulose by itself is most of the structural polysaccharide in the world. But animals make some too, including chitin, shown here. Chitin is strong stuff, which is why insects use it or produce it to make their exoskeletons out of. You know, we have an endoskeleton. Our hard parts are interior and surrounded by soft parts, but it's just the opposite for insects. They have a plate armor, basically, is what it amounts to, made out of chitin, structural polysaccharide, and then their entire inside is soft. We take advantage of the strength of chitin to produce surgical thread, for instance, which needs to be strong. Alrighty. That is a brief overview of polysaccharides. So let's go to the next category, which is lipids, slide 10. And I might have already said this, but I'm going to say it again. Do not use the words lipid and fat interchangeably. One is a set inside the other. Lipids is a bigger set. Fats are just one type of lipid. So all fats are lipids, but not all lipids are fats. All right? But we're starting the conversation about lipids off on slide 10 with fats as an example. And the top is not a fat, but it's kind of a fat on its way to being built. The bottom is a fat. By the way, there are three completely interchangeable terms you can use for a fat. You can call it a fat, easy to say and spell, or you can call it either of two more descriptive words, triglyceride, which is what most biologists would call it, or triacylglycerol, which is what most biochemists would call it. Both of those are better than fat in terms of actually describing the thing, though, because tri means three, right? By the way, the word triacylglycerol, what does that tell you? What does that tell you about what kind of molecule it is? Glycerol by itself is what kind of thing? Well, from the glyc, yes. But what about the OL? It's an alcohol, which means it has a hydroxyl in it, right? Not the fat, but the glycerol. So let's look at the thing being built at the top. The part shaded in ecru or whatever color that is, if you just consider that by itself, the glycerol, it's not hooked to anything yet, that is a full molecule in its own right. And it is an alcohol, right? All that's required to be an alcohol is to include at least one hydroxyl. Well, it has three hydroxyls, so it's a triple alcohol when it's by itself. But those OHs that make it an alcohol each contain an H, right? Which is one of the requirements for the two parts getting together. Something has to have an H, something has to have an OH. And so really these are three connection points that glycerol has for connecting the rest of the components that will eventually make up the whole fat. And we see one of the rest of the components shaded in orange at the top here. It's a fatty acid. It's also, if it's by itself, a complete molecule. Now, look at the left edge of the fatty acid. What do you recognize there? No, I'm talking about just by itself. Nothing's happening yet. Just the molecule.
Carbonyl.
It's not a carbonyl group. It's a carboxyl group, right? It looks like a carbonyl and a hydroxyl, but that whole thing, remember, is a carboxyl. So a fatty acid is a carboxyl group connected to all the rest of this, which is just carbons and hydrogens, right? If it weren't for that carboxyl group, how would you classify a fatty acid? If it were not for the carboxyl, if it didn't have the carboxyl. Well, not methane, but methane is another example of what I'm trying to say it is. What is methane? What category of... It's more than just carbon. What kind of thing is methane? The simplest example of what? A hydrocarbon, right? And if a fatty acid didn't have the carboxyl, it would be a hydrocarbon. It's nothing but C's and H's the rest of the way, right? So technically it's not a hydrocarbon because of that carboxyl. But it almost is. And what did I tell you is... I told you various things about hydrocarbons, but what's an important thing about hydrocarbons? Yes. But as far as their uses are concerned, both biologically and industrially, they are excellent fuels, right? That's why gasoline is just a mixture of hydrocarbons. There's a lot of energy contained in carbon-hydrogen bonds. So fatty acids also are excellent sources of energy. And in fact, they contain a lot more energy than a monosaccharide. Monosaccharides are the master fuels, but they don't have the highest energy density. Energy density refers to how much energy is contained in a gram of that stuff. Fatty acids have more than twice as much energy per gram, or fats, which are made of fatty acids, than monosaccharides do. Well, more about building this, though. The carboxyl end of a fatty acid contains an OH, right? That's the other necessary part for a dehydration reaction to occur. So that's what's happening here. A glycerol is being linked to one fatty acid at one of its three connection points. Now, if this were two monosaccharides being linked together, what do we call that bond? No, not the molecule, the bond. No. When you form a bond between two monosaccharides, you form a glycosidic linkage, right? Here you're doing the same thing. It's also a dehydration reaction, but this isn't called a glycosidic linkage. It's not sugar involved, which glycosidic means. This is an ester linkage. An ester linkage is what forms between a fatty acid and a glycerol molecule. So that's complete as far as this fatty acid is concerned, but the glycerol can connect at two more places. So a complete fat has three fatty acids individually connected by ester linkages to that same glycerol. And only when there are three in place is it properly called a fat, or triglyceride, or triacylglycerol. Now, because fats have such high energy density, like I said, more than twice as much energy as a gram of protein or a gram of carbohydrate, that's why we store our extra energy as fat, even if it wasn't fat that we took in as food. You know, the candy manufacturers love to put on their labels, like Jolly Ranchers, which is pure sugar, no fat, which is true. But if you're taking in more energy from food than you need, you're going to turn it into fat to store it, because that's a more efficient way of storing it. If we had to store our food, our extra energy that we're not using at the moment, as protein or as carbohydrate, we would have to weigh a lot more because it has a lower energy density, so it would take more grams of that stuff to store the same amount of energy. Okay, so that's a major use of fats. They also provide thermal insulation, keeping us either cold or warm, depending on what the environment is. And they also are important in forming cushion to protect deeper structures. Like there's fat around the kidneys to pad them, and various other places in the body. Okay, but notice that in this case, and this does not have to be true. Well, actually, before I even get to that, let me just say, this is a fat, but there are multiple different possible fats. This is just one example of a fat. Now, there's only one glycerol. All glycerols are the same. And it takes a glycerol to make a fat. So since there's only one kind of glycerol, and since there are multiple kinds of fats, what does that tell you about fatty acids? What must be true, logically, about fatty acids? If there are multiple kinds of fats, but only one kind of glycerol.
They all have the same glycerol?
Yes, but how can there be multiple kinds of fats if all glycerol is the same? Rearranging what?
Structure.
They all have carboxylates.
That's true, they all do, but how does that make them different? What I was getting at is that since all glycerol is the same, but fats are different from each other, That must mean that the other component, fatty acids, are different. There's multiple versions of fatty acids. All right? And that's why there can be different fats. Every fat, though, has three fatty acids connected to it. Now, in this picture, it just happens to be the case that this particular fat is made up of three of the same fatty acid. That doesn't have to be true. Notice that each of these three fatty acids is identical. Doesn't have to be true. Before we go to the next slide, can you think of a way in which you could change this fatty acid to make it different from what it is? What could be different about it? To be a fatty acid, it has to have a carboxyl and a hydrocarbon tail. But how could it be different from the one that's shown? Yes, or longer. Think about building this, right? Nothing's saying you had to stop at this carbon. You could add another carbon here instead of this hydrogen and keep doing this pattern. Or you could have stopped right here. So one fundamental way in which fatty acids can differ from each other is in the length of the hydrocarbon chain. And so that is enough of a way to make different fats, because fats can be built out of any fatty acids. They could be differing lengths. But that's not the only way that fatty acids differ from one another. Slide 11 explains this. At the top, we have what is called a saturated fat, on the bottom, an unsaturated fat. What does the word saturated mean in everyday language? When do you say something is saturated? What? Right, full. It means full, right? You've probably heard the phrases saturated fats before. The same words apply to fatty acids individually. It can be either saturated or unsaturated. But let me just, it's better to look at this in the previous slide for a moment, if we can see the C's and H's. Notice that all of these fatty acids have only single bonds between the carbons in the tail. Right? Every one of those is a single bond. And once again, thinking about modeling, if you do that, then every carbon somewhere in the middle of this chain is going to have two bonds, just with the two carbons on either side, leaving two more holes in it, right? Has a valence of four. So the only way to satisfy a carbon that's connected just by single bonds to two other carbons is to fill the other holes with hydrogens. And therefore, a fatty acid that has only single bonds between carbons, and I'm not talking about the carboxyl, that's a double bond between a carbon and an oxygen. Between the carbons, only single bonds. If you make it that way, then that hydrocarbon tail will be able to hold the maximum number of hydrogens. In other words, it will be saturated with hydrogens. Do you see that? If you only have single bonds in that chain. That's why they called them saturated fatty acids. They're saturated with hydrogens. But imagine just on one of these bonds, which is all it takes, turning that into a double bond between carbons. To do that, you have to get rid of a hydrogen from each carbon to open up another hole in each of those atoms, right? Do you agree with that? And therefore, two hydrogens wouldn't be allowed in. So as soon as you have just one or more double bond between carbons, then you're not holding the maximum number of hydrogens that could be held if you didn't have that double bond. And that's why those fatty acids are called unsaturated fatty acids. So the words saturated and unsaturated first applies to fatty acids individually. But we also use those words to describe fats. A saturated fat is one that contains only saturated fatty acids. An unsaturated fat contains at least one unsaturated fatty acid. It could contain two or three. All right? Well, the significance of this is that if you have only single bonds, which a saturated fat has, then this zigzag is straight the whole way down, just like it would be if you modeled it with balls and sticks. But as soon as you put in a pair of springs, making a double bond, it causes a kink in the chain. It's bent. And that makes it pack together with other fatty acids differently. You can just imagine representing fatty acids by pieces of stiff wire, like coat hanger wire, but just not the whole shape, right? Just a length of... And it can be different lengths to represent the fact that fatty acids can be different lengths. But even despite having different lengths, if all you're working with are unbent or straight wires, then you could put them into a box and they're going to pile together nicely with very little space between them, right? Less space, more compact pieces together is more solid than liquid. You know, that's the big difference, other than water, between a solid and a liquid, is that the solid has particles even closer together than in liquid. But if you have a bunch of bent wires, and especially if they're bent at different positions, and you haphazardly throw them into the same box, they're not going to stack together nicely. There's going to be a lot of space between them, right? So they're going to be more like liquid than solid. Well, animals produce primarily saturated fatty acids and therefore saturated fats, which, because of this packing together nicely, those tend to be more solid at room temperature, like butter, for instance. Plants, on the other hand, make primarily unsaturated fats. Those kinks make it looser, and so at the same temperature, that's more liquid, like oils. But they're both fats. All right. That's fats, just one kind of lipid. Let's go to 12 now. Here you have something that looks similar to a fat, but has some important differences. This is a phospholipid, not a fat. It's a phospholipid. And it is impossible to overstate the importance of this molecule to biology. No organisms would exist without this molecule by itself. Life wouldn't have started. And I'll explain more of that in a minute, but let's talk about the similarity between this and a triglyceride, or fat. You have a glycerol, just like you do in any fat. It's the same exact stuff, triple alcohol, three connection points for connecting with pieces that you want to hook. Just like in a fat, you can hook a fatty acid, but unlike a fat, that's done only twice instead of three times in a phospholipid. So it has two fatty acid tails, not three. That leaves another connection point on the alcohol, the glycerol, which instead of binding it to a fatty acid is bound to a phosphate group, which you should recognize in yellow, especially because it's labeled phosphate. Well, maybe you don't remember from learning it originally as a functional group, but you can see here that a phosphate group is actually ionized. One of those four oxygens is an ion. So it is charged, in other words. A phosphate group is charged, which is beyond polar, right? Polar is partially charged. Ions are fully charged. And that is the reason we exist, in a nutshell. Hydrocarbons not only make good fuel, and remember the fatty acid tails are mostly hydrocarbon. Another thing I told you about hydrocarbons in general is that the carbon-hydrogen bonds that you find in hydrocarbons are nonpolar, because carbon and hydrogen have roughly the same electronegativity values. So the sharing of the pair of electrons between a C and an H is almost equal. And what did you learn about properties of solvent exercise that you did in lab about polar and nonpolar? What you should have learned is that polar things like to be around other polar things. They mix well. Nonpolar things mix well with other nonpolar things, but polar and nonpolar don't mix well, which is why oil floats on water. They don't mix. One is polar, the water. One is nonpolar, the fat, the oil. Well, here we have a very special molecule, a phospholipid. It's an example of an amphipathic molecule. The pathic part of that word refers to feeling, like in empathy or sympathy or pathos. What about the amphi part? What does that mean? Not bigger, no. What other word, common word that you have used almost certainly has amphi in it, or words? Which one? Yeah, amphibian. Good example. Once again, the bi, just like in symbiosis and biology, means life. Amphi means dual or both. So an amphibian gets named for the fact that it has a dual lifestyle, meaning it lives part of its life on land, part of its life in water. And similarly, an amphitheater is partly indoors, partly outdoors. So this refers to a duality. Amphipathic means having dual feelings or dual preferences, in a sense, which of course the molecule doesn't have feelings or preference. But that's why it was named. An amphipathic molecule is one that has part of its structure that is nonpolar and another part of its structure polar. When you use the cartoon version of a phospholipid, it's always drawn with a circular head and two tails. The tails are the fatty acids. They're mostly hydrocarbons, so they are nonpolar. The head is polar, in fact, beyond polar, because the phosphate has a charge. All right? Well, the head, being polar, doesn't have any problem being around other polar things, including water, which is polar. The tails, though, don't want to be around water because they are nonpolar. So we have corresponding words other than polar and nonpolar. What corresponds to polar is the word hydrophilic, which literally means water-loving. What corresponds to nonpolar is hydrophobic, water-fearing. They don't want to be around polar things. And that is the importance of the molecule, because in slide 13 we can see what happens without any life. So this happened before there was life, but it can also happen now if you just don't involve any organisms. If you just have millions of these phospholipids, just individual molecules, and you put them into sterile water, no life, they will automatically assemble into this bilayer, as it's called, a phospholipid bilayer. This is showing just part of what would be an overall sphere, an empty bag made out of two layers of phospholipids. This is one monolayer, this is the other monolayer. And they will do this automatically simply because the tails that are hydrophobic, because they're nonpolar, are trying to avoid being around water, either on the inside of the bag or on the outside of the bag. The heads, on the other hand, have no problem being directly in contact with either the inside or the outside water because the heads are polar, like water is. So this happens automatically, and this is how the first cells came into existence. This is not a cell yet because it doesn't have all the ingredients, but before there were first successful cells, there were these little bags made out of phospholipids. Once phospholipids came into existence and accumulated in the environment, kind of like that experiment we looked at. Okay, so this is not a complete plasma membrane, which defines the cell. Keep in mind that a cell defines life, right? It's the structural unit of life. Life itself is the reactions that occur in cells. Metabolism doesn't occur outside of cells, it occurs inside of cells because they are segregated from the rest of the universe by that membrane that defines the cell. Well, that membrane, called the plasma membrane, is chiefly made out of phospholipids for all organisms that have ever existed. But it can't be, the plasma membrane can't be purely phospholipids because certain things won't be able to get in or out. And that's why in a living cell, that phospholipid bilayer substructure is also has studded in it at various places, things like proteins and other things we'll talk about that allow it to serve as a semi-permeable membrane. 14. We're still in lipids. You saw a slide in a previous chapter of two molecules that look very similar to this. Do you remember what they were in that slide? Yeah, testosterone and estrogen. Or estradiol was the specific estrogen. This is not testosterone and it's not estrogen, but it is the molecule that can be made into either of those steroid hormones or any other steroid hormone in an animal. All the steroid hormones in an animal start as this lipid molecule, which is cholesterol. Impossible for an animal to live without cholesterol, even though it gets a bad name in the press because too much can cause problems, but too little kills you. It's impossible to live without it for an animal. But, by the way, the word cholesterol, what does that tell you about it? It's also an alcohol. Well, you can see it is right here. There's an OH. The ster part, as in stereo, means three-dimensional or solid. And col, by the way, is another name for bile. Cholesterol is just one of several ingredients of bile produced by the liver, but it's an important ingredient. And that's why it's called cholesterol, because it literally means bile solid alcohol. Anyway, cholesterol is not only important for being the precursor to all the steroid hormones in animals, it also is an important component of membranes, plasma membranes. It affects their permeability. And it also is a precursor in animals to vitamin D. It's a kind of an interesting exception because most things that are classified as vitamins, which are named that because they are vital, you cannot live without vitamins for various reasons, but most vitamins are classified as vitamins because, vital as they are, we cannot make them. We don't have the molecular machinery to make vitamins, which means to continue to live, we have to get them from the food that we eat, from some other organism that we eat. Usually it's bacteria that make the vitamins. But vitamin D is an exception because we can make vitamin D as long as we have sunlight and cholesterol. Cholesterol in the skin gets struck by ultraviolet radiation from sunlight, and that transforms it into a similar but different structure called cholecalciferol, which then travels to the liver through the blood. The liver sticks on another OH, making it a double alcohol called calcidiol. Diol meaning two alcohols, two hydroxyls. Then that travels through the bloodstream to the kidneys, which adds a third OH, making it calcitriol. And that's the active form of vitamin D, which then travels to the small intestine, where things get absorbed from the diet. And its major job as vitamin D is to greatly increase the efficiency of absorbing calcium, which is important. We can't live without calcium either, but without the help of vitamin D, we can't do a very good job of absorbing it. So it's an important lipid. Don't allow it to only be bad-mouthed. Animals make cholesterol, though. Others don't. Plants, for instance, do not make cholesterol, which is why if you're on a vegan diet, I'm vegan, and so I don't take in any cholesterol dietarily. But that doesn't mean my cholesterol level is zero, right? Why is that? Right, I am an animal. The reason that animals that people eat have cholesterol is because they're animals. They can't live without it. They make their own. Well, so do I. I'm an animal. I just don't take in any additional cholesterol. I have my own, though. Plants have similar sterols, by the way, but they're not cholesterol. They're called phytosterols, which literally means plant sterol. Phyto means plant. And fungi make an even different version called ergosterols, fungus sterols. They're all lipids, though. Yeah, let me go back.
Can your body also try to cholesterol?
Yeah.
Is that because they're intaking too much cholesterol from eating it?
Well, that's one way for that to happen. But it's possible for a vegan to have too high cholesterol because the body very efficiently recycles it. Like I said, it's an ingredient of bile. So the gallbladder stores the bile temporarily from the liver. And that's why another name for the gallbladder, by the way, is the cholecyst or bile bag. And it squeezes to release the bile into the gut as we digest. That's effectively putting it outside of the body, right? Because it's putting it into that alimentary canal. But we reabsorb most of that. So it emulsifies fats, it makes it easier to digest, but we take it back in. And some people just too efficiently recycle it. And they make more. They end up making more than they need, so you can have high cholesterol even as a vegan. But it's just made even worse if you, in addition to have already enough in your body, you take a bunch in from your food because your body doesn't know whether it came from food or from your cells, and it's still going to recycle it through the gut. The final slide that I'll... Yeah, go ahead.
I was just wondering, is every corner on that structure carbon?
Unless it's in this one, it is. Yeah, because it's not labeled as anything else. Any corner or bend in a zigzag,
it's always carbon.
Or a tip is carbon. Right. For instance, this is shorthand for three carbons and enough hydrogens to fill it in.
Okay, so there's hydrogens here.
There has to be hydrogens to satisfy the valence.
Okay, that's what I'm talking about.
So this is really shorthand for this. And that's why they did that, because that's a pain in the ass to do over and over. Now, I can't finish this next slide or even really start it much, slide 15. But typically, when I include a table in a slideshow, it's one that I'm not going to bother reading to you. I just keep it there for study purposes. This one, though, I do next time want to talk about a little bit. We're done with lipids now. We're going into proteins. And just what I want to say before we adjourn is that you can see that proteins have a hell of a lot of different functions. Proteins do all of the important jobs in all cells, and this is why proteins give you your traits directly, right? But notice that this is not only a long list of functions, but those functions are radically different from each other. So the reason that can be true is that there's no limit to the number of different shaped proteins you can make, and shape is everything when it comes to proteins. They have their functions because of their shapes. We'll talk more about it later, though.